So good afternoon. I'm very pleased to welcome today our distinguished seminar speaker, Professor Susan Murphy from Harvard University. So Professor Murphy obtained her PhD in statistics from University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill in 1989. And after her PhD, she's held position in various US universities, including Penn State and the University of Michigan, where she was the Robbins Professor of Statistics. She joined Harvard University in 2017, where she's currently Professor of Statistics on Professor of Computer Science. Professor Murphy is a world expert in experimental design, causal inference, and sequential decision making, and has particular interest in digital health. So her work has been extremely influential, and accordingly, she's received numerous honors, including, among many others, the Fisher Award on Lectureship in 2018, and the Guy Sebum Medal of the Royal Statistical Society in 2019. She's also an elected member of the US National Academy of Science and of the US National Academy of Medicine. On top of being a fantastic scientist, Professor Murphy has been doing a lot of work for the statistics community and is a past president of the IMS and of the Bernoulli Society. And now, without further ado, our distinguished speaker, Professor Susan Murphy, will be talking about assessing personalization in digital health.
Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation to speak with all of you. Okay, I'm gonna share my screen.
Yes, you should be able to.
Yes?
Yes.
You should see it now?
Yes.
Let me just fix it so I can see. Okay, great. This is work that's we're engaged in right now. And these are our first efforts in this direction. And it was motivated by our concerns that when you run an online algorithm in this case, these are digital health trials, and you look at the results, sometimes for some individuals, the results look just totally fantastic. It's like you personalized, and now everyone should use your algorithm. And the question, of course, is this spurious? So that got us going down this particular path. And I'll share with you today what our very first steps in this direction are. And this will be focused on heart steps. This is I'll describe that shortly. Okay. Yeah. So I just wanted to mention, you know, this type of research involves large collaborative teams. Because you're developing an algorithm, then you're implementing the algorithm in a trial, and then you're analyzing, you know, and there's usually software engineers involved as well. And I just wanted to shout out three individuals who are particularly, were really made a big impact, and that's Peng Liao. He's a postdoc in my lab. Kelly Zhang, she's a computer science PhD student, also in the lab. And then Zeyang Ji, who's an incoming first year Harvard PhD student. So what I'll do is first I'll describe heart steps and then we'll go on to the issue of personalization. Okay, so heart steps was funded to construct this activity coach. It's on your phone, and individuals wear a wristband tracker. And it's for individuals who are high risk of coronary artery disease. And there's three studies that are part of this. And you see the first study was only 6 weeks. And then the next two that ran into each other was 3 months and 9 month studies. And I say these studies are micro-randomized, and I say in particular, the last two studies are personalized. And I hope as I go through, you'll see what I mean by that. If not, just put a question in the chat and I can make that clear. Okay, so in all digital interventions, there's many intervention components. We're gonna only focus on one intervention component. And that's whether or not to send a notification. It would appear on the individual's lock screen of their smartphone. And the content of this notification is tailored to where the individual is at the moment, the day of the week, what the weather's like, and so on. And you can see an example on the right-hand side. And this appeared in the morning. It was actually a very cold morning. So you can see that it's trying to get me to think about, you know, reframe my view of cold mornings and about walking to work today. So all the little suggestions are intended to help you be more active wherever you are at that moment in time. And we want to decide, should we send one or should we not? Should the algorithm send one or should it not, shouldn't? And there's five times a day at which these notifications might be sent. And those five times are user specific. They have to do with the way that individual organizes their life. And the reward, what's called a reward, or in our world, an outcome, a near time outcome, is the 30 minute step count after these time points. So, and the reason why it's only 30 minutes is because the content of the notification is all about being active in that moment. So when you think about data from one of these three trials that I mentioned on two slides ago, the data, what it looks like is on each user, it's a time series of tuples. I'll call it state S, action A, reward R. It's a whole time series. And the number of time points depends on whether or not the user was in the three-month or the nine-month study. At each time point, the sensors on the wearable as well as on the phone pick up the person's current context or state. And then an action, that is send the notification versus not, is made by an algorithm, and we'll discuss that shortly. And in our case, we're only focusing on send versus not send. And then after that, the sensors on the tracker record the 30-minute step count. And we're going to focus on a log of the 30-minute step count, mainly because step counts are highly right skewed. And in particular, the notation I'm going to use throughout is the mean of that log 30-minute step count given current state and current action. A action is either one or zero, send a notification versus not, is denoted by this lowercase r of SA. You should be able to see my pointer here. And I'll use this notation repeatedly throughout. Okay, so now about the algorithm that was used online as the trial went on to determine whether or not a notification was sent at each of the five times per day. So what I'm gonna give you just some small aspects of this algorithm because I really wanna get in to the latter part of the talk where I talk about whether or not, how to assess how well the algorithm personalized. So I'll only talk a little bit about the algorithm itself, and I can speak about it more if people have questions. These are online decision-making algorithms. And the idea is to select these actions, send a notification versus not, in order to maximize some sort of outcome. And in this case, it's law average of the step counts. And it's always, in this world, it's always subject to both a number of constraints, which are often expressed in a very qualitative way. And you have to figure out how to quantify them. So one constraint is to permit what's called off-policy learning after the data collection is over. So in the field of reinforcement learning, that's what this belongs to. There is a lot of interest in understanding, well, if I had used some other way of selecting the actions, how might the sum of the rewards behave? So you want to permit that kind of learning. Those kinds of analyses after the data collection ceases. There's also, because of the area, the domain this is in, user burden is a big issue. And habituation, that is when people no longer even notice the notifications, that's also a big issue. So these impose enormous constraints on any algorithm you're going to run. And you can't use these trials, the length of the trials have to do with how much funding there is. So you want an algorithm that doesn't know when the trial is going to end. So what we did in V2 and V3, that's the 3-month and the 9-month study, was we took we started off with a banded algorithm, a Bayesian type of algorithm called Thompson sampling, and we altered it in a variety of ways. And I'll just point out some of the ways in which we altered it. And the idea is this algorithm, which is running, it ran on the cloud and communicated with the phone and the tracker in real time. It's supposed to be personalizing the decision as to whether or not to send a notification versus not at each of those five times a day. So when you think of an online decision-making algorithm, as a statistician, I always think of these algorithms as being composed of two sub-algorithms, two elements. One is what people will call a learning algorithm. This is just an incremental statistical method. And the goal is to learn some characteristic of the multivariate of the distribution of the data. In this case, it's to learn the mean of the log 30-minute step count given state and action. And in our case, we used a Bayesian linear regression model. It's a particularly simple, it can be viewed as a simple, a Gaussian process model with a very simple kernel, and that actually opens doors to us in a variety of ways. So that was one element. So it was just essentially an incremental statistical method. In our case, it's Bayesian, and you can think of it as linear regression. And then there is an action. So the second element of this online decision-making algorithm is an action selection strategy. And that strategy is all about how are you going to use the outputs of the learning algorithm to select the actions at five times a day as the individual experiences the mobile app. So what we're doing here is called posterior sampling. At least nowadays, it's called posterior sampling. I don't think when Thompson first invented this, he was thinking in this way, but nowadays it's called posterior sampling. And the idea is what you do is you calculate the posterior. So your learning algorithm is Bayesian. So you can calculate a posterior probability that the treatment effect that it, in the current state S, you calculate the posterior probability that the treatment effect in the current state S is greater than zero. So that's RS1 minus RS0. And you calculate that posterior probability that's greater than zero. And then what you do is you take that, you take that posterior probability and you randomize. So you're randomizing, it is the sequential experimentation setting, but the randomization probabilities are tied to how the Bayesian algorithm anticipates the effect of sending a notification in that particular state, the state the individual is in right now. This is a greedy personalization. So what do I mean by greedy? This algorithm, if you base your work on if you take a banded algorithm and you work around that area, then you're not paying attention to the effect of the notifications on future rewards. And clearly that's not a good idea here, but there's a bias variance trade-off. And in our case, we decided to just focus greedily on this time, would it be useful to send a notification or not? Okay, so I just wanted to talk just a little bit about the learning algorithm, the first element of this online decision-making procedure, just to provide a little bit more context. So what we do is we use, in this particular setting, because of the high noise that one incurs in these kinds of real-life experimental and sequential decision-making problems, we use a very low-dimensional treatment effect model. And you see it here, it's a linear model in features, and all of the features of state were handcrafted by the scientific team. There were five thetas of five dimensional. And in fact, we always use informative priors. I was never a Bayesian before. I have now become a complete Bayesian with informative priors. Forget about this non-informative business. And the way we form our informative prior in this particular case, and in general in this setting, is you have a prior study. And we did, we had Heartsteps V1. And we could use that study to form the prior for V2 and V3. I want to mention some things about this prior because it's going to be important when we go on. So this prior, theta is five-dimensional, and I'll show you the features later on a further slide. But the first feature is just the overall effect of sending a notification versus not. And that was the only feature that had a positive theta. That is, the prior had a positive mean for that feature. The mean for all the other features, the remaining four, was zero, okay? So this is important to remember for later on. So we're starting off the trial with a prior that says we anticipate there to be a positive effect of sending a notification overall across all states. We also had a baseline week for each user. Each user had a week where we just collected data on the user. We randomized whether to send a notification with probability 2.5 at each of the five times a day. And now I want to talk just a little bit about the action. We did a lot of things to this algorithm, but I just wanted to mention that, the parts I mentioned on the prior slide. Now I just want to give you talk a little bit about that action selection strategy, which was posterior sampling. And this was a sad case because I was very naive when I started down this path. And so we actually had to, the first set of people that came in the first V2, we ended up not being able to use as part of the study. And I'll indicate why that happened. What is posterior sampling does? What it does, you calculate that posterior probability, the treatment effect is greater than zero. And then you randomize with that probability. So look at number one. In some states, the posterior distribution of the treatment effect is going to be highly peaked and centered around zero. And so what that means is your randomization probability will average around 0.5. So with probability 0.5 on average, if there's no evidence of an effect, you're sending a notification. This makes no sense whatsoever from a domain science perspective, particularly if you're worried about bothering people and having them habituate to your messages. This is definitely not desirable. We didn't even think about this at first. And then in other states, you'll get a large amount of information. Your Gaussian posterior will be highly peaked around a positive weight for that state. And you're going to think, whoa, you know, you really should send a notification in that state. But again, we got to remember, this is a setting in which people get overburdened by having their phone pinging all the time. Do you really want to send that notification every time you're in that state? No. You don't really want to do that. So I'll tell you what we did. We're trying to improve this, but we became engineers. We have to, you know, we have to put this into the field. It has to be. And we also needed to permit off-policy learning after the data collection ceases. That was the third issue. Now, to learn, you must, in any given state, unless you're willing to make a lot of assumptions, to learn, you must see sometimes you choose action zero and sometimes you choose action one. You can't just always choose one of the actions. Okay, so what was our solution? Our solution was to take that posterior probability and clip it. And the little graph, I just drew that little graph in blue on the right-hand side, and this is how we clipped it. So if the posterior probability that it was really a good idea to send that message in that state is above 0.8, it becomes 0.8. If the posterior probability is around 0.5, indicating there's probably not much of a treatment effect, we send the notification with probability 0.2. Now, why are we doing this with 0.2? There is a lot of evidence in this world that variability is therapeutic. So we always want to send, every now and then we want to send a message just to shake things up. So the lower bound is 0.2, the upper bound is 0.8, and that's what these two values at the bottom, the two sentences at the bottom of the slide are about. So PU, that's the upper value, 0.8 in our case. This is determined by our need to do off-policy learning. We can't have one because then we won't be able to learn off-policy. It's a disaster. And from a domain science perspective, we don't want to overburden our users. PL, which is 0.2 in our setting, we don't want it to be zero. We have to be able to do off-policy learning. But here also, that's where the health benefit of having some variability. And we also are concerned, even though I'm not dealing with it today, non-stationarity is a big issue in this world. So, and we want to allow in our after-study analyses to investigate that. Okay, so we ran this algorithm. I just gave you a very high level view. We actually did a number of other things to make the algorithm suitable for this type of a setting. It's over, the studies are over. Did we achieve anything like personalized digital health? Okay, so I'm gonna have a whole series. I think there's like 7 questions that I wanna address as we go through. And this banded algorithm, or it was a generalization of a banded algorithm, it was run separately on each of the N individuals, 91 individuals. When I say it's run, it was used to choose whether or not to send a notification in each state at each time, 5 times a day over the duration of that individual study. So some first questions I'd like to ask is, you know, we thought from HeartSteps V1 that there was an overall treatment effect. And our prior pointed us in that direction. Is there evidence from this data that that's the case? So that's not about personalization, it's just on average. And then the next is more closely related to personalization. Is there evidence of heterogeneous effects? And how do you think about it in this problem? So here we are, we're thinking about this. We have no idea what to do. So we go back to the literature, the old, very, very mature literature in clinical trials. This is a classical meta-analysis. So if you're into machine learning, you know about meta-analysis, meta-learning. This is not meta-learning in machine learning, okay? This is classical meta-analysis. In fact, at the bottom of the slide, I have a reference to a really lovely tutorial that came about at the maturity of this area, when this area had really matured, 22 years ago. Very old area of science. So the idea here is the way we're going to think about it is each user, we have 91 users, is a clinical trial. This is how we're going to think in our head. Each user has their own unknown vector of true treatment effect coefficients. So I subscript them by 0 because that's their true treatment effect coefficient, and I indicates user. And then I have to estimate each user. Each user has to have an estimator of that user's treatment effect coefficient. And what I use is the vector of posterior means. And what I'm thinking in my mind is this was just a Gaussian, a Bayesian linear regression. This is just ridge regression here. All I did was a ridge regression. My theta hat I is just a weight from a ridge regression. That's all it is. You can see what theta I is. It's a weight. Remember, theta I is a 5-dimensional vector. It's the treatment effect model. So in classical meta-analysis, there's 2 ways that people think. The first way is you say, all I care about are the users, or in their case, the trials in front of me. So all I care about is these 91 users. I don't care about anything else. I only want to make inference about these 91 users. And what one does is one makes an approximates the distribution of the estimator we derived from a ridge regression by a normal. It should have mean, the true underlying regression coefficient for that user I. And then there's some variance, and the variance has to do with the fact that we didn't observe this user over really long. We didn't have an infinite number of examples on this user. So the error variance. The second way you think that one thinks in classical meta-analysis is population inference. So here you think my N users, N equal 91 in our case, are a subset of a population of users. And we want to make statements about that whole population. And in this case, actually in this study, this made a lot of sense for us to think that way as well. And the reason is because all of these individuals are from our patients in the Kaiser healthcare system in Seattle, and they had all just been diagnosed with stage one hypertension. So if the healthcare system was thinking about, should we roll out an app for our patients who have just been diagnosed with stage one hypertension, this type of inference would be relevant. In this case, you make an additional assumption, and this additional assumption is that as you vary from one user to the other across the population, that varies normally, and the mean five-dimensional vector of treatment effects is theta sub pop. And then there's some variation among these five-dimensional vectors as you go from one user to the other in the whole population. Okay, so I'm gonna start answering my two questions that I pose. I'm gonna repeat the questions and I'm gonna answer them. The first question is in this vein of population inference. So is there some evidence of an overall average treatment effect on our 30-minute step count? And in classical, the way one forms a statistic is you get a weighted average of your user-specific estimators. Okay, so I'm gonna go through that. This is just, I'm not doing anything special here. This is classical meta-analysis. So this little e, that's a vector, all zeros except a one in one place, and it's just being used to pick out one of the members of the five-dimensional vector of theta. And the weight, so we get a weighted average, and those weights are the within user variance plus the variance from user to user. So it's classical, this is classical statistics. And you weight your person-specific estimators by these weights. Now, here's this little green table. It gives you the names of the features. So the first is the overall send notification versus not binary. Then we had a feature, how many times recently, it was an exponentially discounted feature of how many times recently we've been sending you notifications. The third feature, engagement, was whether or not people were going more often to the app to track their physical activity than usual. Location was whether or not they were in a structured environment or not. And step variation was how variable their step count was in that same time period over the last week. Okay, so you do this and you think, okay, you do the statistics, you get your confidence interval, and you think, oh, this is great. We have a confidence interval, it doesn't contain zero, that's lovely. And so there seems to be some overall effect of sending a notification versus not. On average across individuals, it's not talking about personalization. And then you go to that second row and you realize that, and in fact, we anticipated this, that the more someone has been notified, the less responsive they tend to be. And in fact, this is a large negative coefficient, and the confidence interval is very wide, indicating there's a lot of uncertainty. This pretty much kills the treatment effect, except the average estimator, except when the recent dose is very, very close to zero. And to hit that point a little stronger, I'm going to look at a particular state here. And the state is the person is experienced recently an average dose. They're currently engaged with the app. They've been tracking their behaviors. They're at home or work, so in a structured environment, and their recent variability in their activity has been low. So I'm just going to focus on that state. And I'm going to ask, well, what's the confidence interval for the treatment effect in that state? So this is a confidence interval for the average across the population treatment effect in that state. And you see, indeed, there's just not much going on. There's not a lot of evidence there. Right. It's depressing. So then we asked, well, what about heterogeneity between users? Is the better action user specific. And this is now all of a sudden we switch our hats and we start focusing just on these 91 users. And the test statistic here is based on the variation between users in their estimated regression, these coefficients in the treatment effect. Again, E is this is a vector, all zeros except for one, one in one of the entries, depending on which coefficient you want to pick out. And the average that you get a variation among each individual's estimated treatment effects. And the average is an average, of course, weighted by how variable that treatment effect is. And of course, this average, this WI, it's not overt here, explicit, but it depends on how long that individual was in the study. So here's us using it. So the test is a hypothesis of whether or not the users have, all the users, 91, have the same true treatment effect coefficients. That's what this null hypothesis means, five-dimensional theta. And here we are going from one theta to the next, the five, and you see there's enormous evidence that users differ a great deal one from the other in terms of their own treatment effect coefficients. Lots of heterogeneity. Very interesting. Okay. So now what I'm going to do is if you're familiar with reinforcement learning or bandits, you know, one of the things we always want to do is estimate the average reward and compare that average reward under different policies. So that's what I'm going to do here as well. Okay, so on average, does the banded algorithm select more effective actions, i.e. send a notification versus not, than the prior? Because remember, the prior was an informative prior. We built it off of prior data on similar individuals, exact same interventions. Okay, so I just want to make clear what I mean by average, by how am I quantifying if more effective actions. By that, I mean you get a higher average reward. So here you have the value function, V sub I for the ith user. Pi is a particular policy for choosing actions. And this is just the expectation of the ith user's reward function, which is a function of state and action. So it's this expectation is averaging over the states that that user experiences, as well as any stochasticity in the policy pi. And our policies are always stochastic. So it averages both over the stochasticity, the states that that user finds themselves in, as well as the stochasticity in the average. And we want to know, does the banded algorithm produce a higher value, a higher average reward than if we had just built our policy from the prior data and ran with it? So what we're going to do is we estimate that average reward under our bandit. Now, under our bandit algorithm, our generalized bandit algorithm, it's actually it's posterior sampling, right? So the policy is changing with time. So that's the reason why there's a B1 through BTI, because it's the probability of selecting action changes with time. Send a message changes with time. And the estimator of that value is just the average that you see in front of you for that individual. Now, the estimator of the average reward for a different policy, for example, the policy built off the prior, is a way you use importance weighting. There's more sophisticated estimators now in the literature. Okay, I just want to warn you, but this is a first round kind of thing. So we use importance weights, and you can see them on the right-hand side, to weight those observed rewards in order to estimate the average reward under the prior policy. So if we just built the policy from V1, our subs V1, and ran with it, didn't do any, try to do any learning here. Already, we should be thinking in our mind, that prior policy, our subjective prior said there was an effect of sending a suggestion. But then when we went and did these analyses, it didn't look so great, not at least not on average. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Now we're thinking again, we're still in that meta-analysis world, that classical, lovely meta-analysis world. So now what do our thetas, what do they become? They're just one-dimensional now. And theta zero, the ith user's true theta, is the difference between that user's value under the bandit minus that user's value under the prior, the policy form from the prior. And theta hat I is just the estimators of these two things. We don't observe the first term. This is unknown. So what we're going to do, just same as classical meta analysis, and this is generally true under certain conditions on the data structure, that theta hat, that is this estimator in values, the difference in values, is approximately normal. It has some variance because you're estimating it. And so we make this first assumption if we are only interested, we only make the first assumption if we're interested in only these 91 users, I equal 1 to 91. And then we make an additional assumption, that's the second one right here. I have my pointer right below it, that the true difference in values varies from one individual to another in the population according to a normal distribution, sort of like a random effects type of thing. Okay. So the test statistics are identical, no difference. They're identical test statistics. So does the bandit algorithm result in higher average rewards than the policy based on the prior? And in fact, it does. And the confidence interval doesn't contain zero. Now, this is not a big effect. Remember, this is an average over the population. Why do we think this might have happened? Well, the policy built off the prior wanted us to send the notification a lot because the prior said there was a positive effect of sending that notification. The prior mean was positive. But the bandit learns that on average across people, that's not true. So I interpret this as the effect of not bothering people too much. And every now and then it helps on average. Okay, so now let's focus on our 91 users, just our 91, and ask, is that difference in values, the bandit versus the prior? Are those differences, in other words, is the benefit of running a bandit, does that vary from one user to the other? And here this is the second type of hypothesis test, second type of statistic, and it has this hypothesis test, chi-squared distribution. It's incredibly significant. A lot of evidence that the bandit works, that for some people, the bandit gives you very different results than the prior as compared to on average. So, okay, you know, this is all fine and good. And then we wanted to start looking at some exploratory work. And I found, and we're getting closer now to the question. Question 7 was the question that motivated this entire project. And it's still motivating the project. But first I'm gonna go for question six. Our prior, this informative prior built off Hartsips V1 said there was a treatment effect. In fact, it said the treatment effect was pretty strong because it was very strong in Hartsips V1. On average across users, does it appear that the bandit algorithm learns over time? Well, what should the bandit algorithm learn on average across users? It should learn on average across users, there's not much going on. Okay, so the blue curve here is the actual, from the real trial, the actual average posterior mean of the treatment effect. In this particular state, the second bullet point gives you the state. It's the same state we looked at before. As the trial progresses. So here you see this is across decision points, that x-axis, and then the y-axis is that posterior mean. And if you can look close, I don't know, it's hard to see, but the blue curve starts at time zero around 0.47. 0.47 was the prior mean of the overall effect of sending a suggestion versus not in that state. And we suspect from our prior analyses, the analyses I've talked about today, that on average, that didn't bear out. And in fact, okay, so you see the blue curve, it starts to drift down. It's the average posterior mean of the treatment effect as the study progresses. It drifts down towards zero. Okay, so I wanted to understand, was that drift really important? Was it significant, you know, in some way? So here's what we did. We did bootstrap studies. So there's 2,000 black curves. Each black curve is a bootstrap, is a bandit trial, a bandit algorithm applied to each of 91 bootstrap users. Because I'm going to talk to you about how we made a bootstrap user. So what we did was we took our original 91 users' data. We subtracted from every user at each time point the posterior mean of the treatment effect at that time point. And we called the difference between the reward, and we subtracted from the reward the posterior mean of the treatment effect at that time point. We called that difference a residual. It's not mean zero because we just took away the treatment effect. But so now, after we did that subtraction, on each individual, the 91 individuals, we have a time series of state residual, state residual, state residual, state residual. Then what we do is we get a bootstrap sample of these 91 trajectories of state residual, state residual. And on each of the 91, we run a bandit. If the bandit says choose action one, we add back in a treatment effect according to the prior. If the bandit says choose action zero, we don't do anything because, yeah, we leave it because the data has already had that. So, okay, we do that for every person. So we have one bootstrap study of 91 users. A bandit is run on each of the 91. And now what we do is we get this average posterior mean across those 91 bootstrapped users. And that's the black line. A black line is the posterior mean evolving over time. Now, under the ground truth that the prior is correct. And in fact, you see, if the prior were correct, all these lines, it's a big mass because this is a stochastic algorithm. It's a big mass. It goes through time. But the blue line, the truth, rapidly deviates from that mass and goes below. So the actual study very quickly learns that the prior was incorrect. Okay. So I'm getting close to the end. So this again, as I said earlier, we had a number of situations like this. And this is what motivated all this work. And I think, to me, this is really important because right now we have so many examples of AI producing horrendous false results. And we cannot have, I mean, that's our, you know, as a statistician, I want to make sure that whatever we say, I want to try and give you some measure of confidence with whatever we say. Okay, so I'm going to show you a user's data who exhibited very interesting personalization. This was not the only user, it was just one. So remember, this is going on in Seattle. The x-axis is the date in the study. This individual joined the study in November 15th, 2019, pre-COVID. They exited the study, this individual exited the study at the beginning of August 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. Seattle closed down in March. Okay. So let's talk about the y-axis. Each dot is a ratio. It's the ratio of the posterior mean of the treatment effect in that user's current state divided by the posterior standard deviation of the treatment effect in that user's current state. And the reason why we're graphing this on the y-axis is this directly leads to the posterior probability. The higher it is, the higher the posterior probability of sending a notification, the lower. So, okay. So each dot is, so there's a dot for every one of these five decision times, you know, a lot of dots are on top of each other. Now the dots have two colors. The blue dots are when the user's current state indicates the person is engaged. And the red dots are when the user's current state indicates the person is now engaged. Here means you're just watching your app, because the app had all kinds of things you could do on it. And the red state means you're just not watching the app quite as much. It's fascinating because in general, if at that contact and that in that state, you haven't been watching the app, then the algorithm says your treatment effect is much lower than if you had, if this individual had been watching, was engaged. That's the blue. This is glorious. I mean, I show this to a domain scientist and they love it, right? Because this is what it means to personalize, is that with higher probability when someone's engaged, they're sent a message. And with lower probability, they're sent a message when they're less engaged. It sounds wonderful. But is this even, I mean, you know, this is a stochastic algorithm. Things happen by chance. Okay, so here's our exploratory data analysis to think about this. And this is only a first effort. There's other ways to think, to pose this problem. Okay, so the blue curve here, again, the x-axis is the date in the study, this individual's date in the study. And the blue curve is their estimated effect of engagement at that time in the study. And it starts off at zero because the prior mean for engagement was zero. All of these curves start off at zero for that reason. And so the blue curve is the real data. There's 2000 black curves. Now what we're doing, instead of, we're getting a bootstrap version, 2000 bootstrap versions of this user. So the way we get a, so let's just think of one bootstrap version of this user. We form that state residual, state residual, state residual, like I talked about in the prior slide. And then for that, just for that user, and now we bootstrap those state residuals now. We resample those. And we run the Bandit algorithm under the ground truth of there's no effect of engagement, but everything else stays the same. So we just set that theta weight for that, posterior mean for that theta equal to zero. So now each black line is how the posterior mean, how what the Bandit thinks for that individual is that individual's posterior mean for the treatment effect as the study progresses. And indeed, you see at the very beginning, the real data is highly consistent with no effect. I mean, the blue curve is well within the mass of the black curves, well within that mass. But as time goes on, the blue curve drifts to the top. And in fact, I have a statistic here, about 8% of the black curves have a positive posterior mean 95% of the time, whereas the blue curve has a posterior, the blue curve has a posterior positive mean, prior mean, posterior mean treatment effect of engagement 95% of the time, and only 8% of the black curves have that. It's very interesting if you compare this to the prior graph, because even though it looks like at the very beginning, you know, way into March and April, that being engaged means it's better to send a message. But the black lines indicate, well, that blue curve is well within the variance that you might expect, even if there's no effect of engagement. It's only when you get to June of 2020 that you start to see some indication that there's enough evidence that really engagement should be taken into account. This is my last slide. So here what we did was we used a sequential online decision-making algorithm, personalization algorithm. But did we achieve personalized digital health, personalized sequential decision-making? So in this whole analysis, what I did was I assumed that each user, that user's state reward followed like a classical Bandit. That is, that prior actions don't influence future rewards. even in that setting, how could you do a better job? Even if you're willing to make that assumption, how could you do a better job assessing personalization? This is completely open. And if the banded environment assumption is violated, which it definitely is, because if I send too many notifications in future, you're probably going to be less responsive. How do you assess this? So how do you assess this in a Markov kind of setting? As far as I know, there's just nothing there. And these are uniquely statistical questions, and they're critical for using AI in sequential decision making. Thanks.
Thank you. So is there any question for Susan? I don't see. If you want to talk, I don't know if you can unmute yourself and speak or leave a question in the chat. So I've got one actually. So I mean, when you work in this kind of context of health, I would be a bit paranoid, omitting some confounders or unobserved confounders. I mean, is there like a lot of study and like people are looking at, being extremely careful in the design of the kind of state space model they consider, these kind of things? I mean, how do you assess this in practice?
Yeah, so these are designed experiments, right? So enormous amount of work goes into deciding what will be sensed. And it is related to what the scientific domain says should be important. That said, this is a very immature area of science. So it's probably implausible. It's implausible that we collected the entire state. And that is the reason why I think we're always going to see some element. We're going to get the appearance of non-stationarity. Not because it might be true, but rather because people are moving to another state, but we don't know it. They look to be in the same state to us. Yeah. So the issue of non-stationarity is, and this is one of the reasons why you don't really ever want to let those probabilities go to one or zero. You want to be able to do intermittent analyses where you off policy analyses and you look, are we getting some evidence of non-stationarity here? Yeah.
Is there any other question? So, I mean, related to your off-policy evaluation, so I've done a bit of that recently. I say you use the one you are presenting was a basic inbound sampling, but I guess obviously for long-time series it doesn't work. So what kind of other things have you developed?
Well, it's a high variance estimator. That's number one. But so right now there's a lot of research. This is a very active area of research. How do you do off-policy estimation when you only have one trajectory? And I think there's a new paper on archive that came out maybe in the last couple of months by Haddad, Susan Athey. She may be on that. And she has a way. Now, a lot of the problem, we did a lot of simulations for this and we didn't see any evidence, but that's not, simulations are not proofs, right? And we also ourselves have work on how you can do estimation after you've adaptively sampled. And there's different ways to do, to wait, to try and adjust for it. The big problem is really when there's, it's under certain scenarios you get aberrant behavior. In our simulations, we didn't see this, but when we're writing all of this up and we'll take whatever's most recent in the literature and use it.
Yeah.
But this is an area, it's great you asked that question because this is an area of very active research. How do you do off-policy learning on one trajectory? Not in independent trajectories in which you have in independent bandits, but one trajectory.
Yeah, I've actually read quite a few papers in reinforcement learning, and I know they are the current methods are not working that well. Basically, can be quite sensitive. And
there's
a lot of questions about the uncertainty of the result of your estimate, even of when you do a
right. It's interesting, though. you have to work hard to get it to misbehave. It's not, it depends, of course, on what you're estimating. If you're trying, and also notice we were clipping 0.2, 0.8. Yes. This changes things enormously. Exactly. And that's why the simulations probably worked out okay for us. If we had allowed the probabilities to get close to 0 or 1, that's where you really get the problems.
Yeah, sure. Is there any other question for Suzanne? Oh. So I've got a question in the chat from Zilin. Which asking you whether you could explain a bit more on the bootstrap sampling within each individual.
Yeah, so there was two types of bootstrap samples, one in which we bootstrapped individuals and one in which we had one individual and we just bootstrapped within that individual. In both cases, the first step was the same. The first step was, so for each individual, we have a whole time series of state action reward, state action reward, state action reward. So what we would do is we calculated the posterior mean at the end of the study of that individual's reward function, their mean reward in that state at that time. So, and we subtracted that from the reward. So we, so it was, now we had state action reward minus posterior mean in that state. State action reward minus posterior mean in that state. I'll call those residuals, those differences. So now we have state action, we throw away the action, state residual, state residual, state residual for each of the 91 individuals. We have a whole series. And then we do the bootstrap sampling under a ground truth that we're trying to test against. It's like a null. And so in the first case, the ground truth was that the prior means were correct. The ones we built off of Hartsteps V1. And so the way that happens is you take one bootstrapped in one individual, which is state residual, state residual, state residual, and you run the bootstrap on that data. So when the boot, the bandit on that one individual. And so when the bandit sees the state, it chooses an action. If the action is one, you add back in the mean from the prior. If not, if the action the bandit chose is zero, you leave the residual alone. It's just the reward now. And you just move through time like that for that one person. And you do it for all 91 people that you bootstrapped. In the case of, in the first case, we bootstrap individuals, we bootstrap trajectories. In the second case, we actually just had one individual, state residual, state residual, state residual, and we bootstrap those little pairs.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Is there any other question for Suzanne? No, well, let's thank Suzanne again.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Sorry, it's a pity you couldn't come to Oxford. I hope we'll be able to welcome you soon in person. So thank you again for
okay.
The great show.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye.